Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
Hello, Ramona Kovar with you, and today on The Book Show, Cambridge University science historian Dr. John Van Wy and Queensland e-text creator Sue Asher talk about their passion for the work of Charles Darwin. And after the launch of the website they've been working so hard to create, Darwin Online, they'll explain why they're equally passionate about making his texts available to everyone, free and in their original form. And novelist Fiona Capp takes us to the Australian goldfields of the 1800s, where independent-minded Gemma Musk hopes to establish herself as a painter, but instead finds herself on the run with an outlaw. And in first person, John Hughes continues reading from his memoir, The Idea of Home. Dr. John Van Wy is a science historian from Cambridge University with a mission to make original material by and about Charles Darwin available, not just to scholars with access to university archives, but to you, me, and the rest of the whole world. In 2002, with a modest amount of funding and the help of volunteers, John started to assemble a website featuring Darwin's published writings, unpublished papers, and private papers. Now the website has around 90,000 images and there's no charge for accessing them. As well as wanting to make the material available to everyone, John and his team insisted that every text was in its original form with nothing omitted. One of the documents now available, for instance, is the first draft of Darwin's Theory of Evolution, complete with scribbles, footnotes and words crossed out. John Wy joins us from a studio in Cambridge in the UK. Welcome to The Book Show, John.
Hello, thank you.
And also with us on the phone from Queensland is Sue Asher, the first volunteer to join this website project. Sue creates e-texts, and she comes from a family background that gives her a particular interest in theories of natural selection, and we'll find out what that is shortly. Hello, Sue. Welcome to The Book Show.
Thank you.
Well, John, if I can first ask you, as a founder and director of the Darwin Online Collection, what possessed you to do this?
Well, my primary motive was to get all of Darwin's writings available for free online because they weren't already there. For a short time I had a research fellowship in Singapore, and when I was there I didn't have any access to almost all of Darwin's books, and I turned to the internet thinking I could get all of them there. Surely it's been done, and it hadn't been done. So it struck me at once that this really needed doing and I could do it.
So what sort of items have you collected?
Well, we started with Darwin's publications because those are reasonably easy to acquire, though some of them are extremely rare and difficult to find. And we began to put together Darwin's books in their original first editions, which is what most scholars need to cite. And we included things like the complete bibliographical information and the page numbers so that you could cite, you know, Darwin said this in this edition on this page, and anyone can go to a library and verify that fact.
So you've got all kinds of things from his working life, but you've also got exchanges with his wife about religion and also Emma Darwin, his wife's recipes for pea soups and puddings. Why include these recipes?
Yes, well, we've recently launched Darwin's Private Papers, which is a vast collection of manuscripts and printed items that belong to Darwin and the Darwin family that are kept in the Cambridge University Library. And we've taken the microfilms of these private papers and have them scanned in and then put up according to a manuscript catalogue so that you can find them. And everything in the Darwin archive is important to someone, and you can't tell what it will be. So instead of us choosing which items we think people will be interested in, what we've tried to do is put up as much as we can so that people can find what might be in there, because it's a vast collection and it hasn't all been studied completely yet. So one could read this for years.
And what do we learn from the footnotes and scrawls on the first draft of the Theory of Evolution, for example, about what Darwin, what his practice was and how his mind works?
Well, Darwin was a notorious scribbler and note taker. He took notes on just about everything. And what you see in documents like that is that they were work in progress. That the theory of evolution didn't just spring forth complete out of his head. You know, there was an old legend that said that he went to the Galapagos Islands and then, Eureka, he came up with his theory there. And that's not true. And here in his actual papers, you can see that the theory evolved. He started out with early notebooks, doubting the stability of species, all of the evidence he'd found about the similarity of the fossils in South America to the creatures that live uniquely there today, and the creatures on the Galapagos and other evidence. He began to put together a theory gradually and amass huge quantities of evidence in his notes. And that material was never fully published in his lifetime. The Origin of Species, his famous work, doesn't have any footnotes. That was just an overview of his theory. He never managed to complete his large-scale publication with all of his evidence. So by providing his private papers and his whole archive of papers, that is Darwin's evidence for his theory of evolution, and a lot more.
Well, let's turn to Sue Asher. As I said, she's an e-text creator and a volunteer with the Darwin Online Project. You were the first volunteer, in fact, to join John back in 2002, Sue. What inspired you to become involved?
Access to documents. I had been actually buying books in the public domain to make into e-text, which just happened to be my hobby. And John offered me access to this magnificent archive, basically for free.
What, so can I just say, why is e-text creating your hobby? What's the attraction?
I started doing it because, really, I was looking for something to do after retiring. And I had always meant to read books that I hadn't read, either at school or later on. And the best way to read some of those books, which are actually unreadable, is to sit up straight and type them out, which I did in the early days when transcription was the way to go. But after that, of course, other means of electronic text capture came in and made it much more accessible and much easier to convert. And that's what John done. John makes all the stuff available to me. I don't have to transcribe it anymore. And it's all free.
Tell us about your family background that helped stir your interest in Darwin, Sue.
Well, my dad and my husband were both beekeepers. And in their time as beekeepers, the emphasis was on selection of queens for breeding. And I just used to listen to my dad's observation about bees, which were fascinating, and he'd been a beekeeper since he was a kid. And then my husband continued in that tradition, and we actually moved out to Australia to a job with an apiarist in New South Wales. And there it was a huge operation and very intense, and they were actually selecting queens and sending them around the world for money. You know, that's what they did as a business. It was a primary, they were primary producers. And I was there in the conversations and listened to people who were very knowledgeable about it, and people who were actually observing the results of what they were doing, what they were getting when they selected queens. And one of the basic texts about bees is right there in The Origin.
Of course, your mother was apparently a fundamentalist Christian.
Oh, absolutely.
So what was her view about Darwin?
Well, she just managed to ignore it. You know, she just went off to church and played the organ for somebody's funeral and
played the organ louder, Mother.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
I wonder whether John, quite a few fundamentalist Christians who don't believe in any of Darwin's theories might be accessing your site 90 to the dozen, trying to get some support for their views.
Oh yes, we believe that the site is used by a very broad range of readers. The fact is that Darwin Online has become, now that it's the most complete collection of Darwin's writings that's ever been assembled. I mean, there isn't even a library that has such a complete collection of all of his scribbles in one place. So it has become the electronic version of Darwin, which is where people go to find out what Darwin said. You can search it all. and if you need to find a name or a species that Darwin may have mentioned, or someone that helped him, that's the place to go. So, of course, yes, people who are both pro and anti-Darwin will use the site, and we know this. But I've found that so far that the reaction of fundamentalists to Darwin Online has been pretty low-key, I think because Darwin Online doesn't make any reference to that or to current debates. It's mostly about the original documents and bringing back to life the 19th century originals.
Are there any documents, John, that you're especially excited to have gotten your hands on?
Yeah, that's a difficult question to answer. There are so many thousands of items on the website. I think one of my favorites is Darwin's pocket diary, or journal. He called it a journal, but it's a pocket diary, in which he noted down where he was and when he was working. And mostly it's a record of how much work he got done and how much time he lost to illness or visiting family and that sort of thing, because his life was so geared towards solving puzzles about nature. And he was driven in one study after another, which culminated in a book or an article. And in this little pocket diary, he notes down from this month to this month, I worked on this chapter, and then I worked on this chapter. And it's very brief, but it's a charming record of his life in science.
So what about you? Are there particular aspects of Darwin's work that intrigue you, or particular texts that you enjoy working on?
I love them all. What I love most is his constant observation. He just simply couldn't help himself. Once he got onto that idea, but I think all his life going right back, he just found evidence wherever he looked. And when you read his writings, it's a series of observations backed up with his own, what he calls, generalizations about those observations. And I think John can back this up if it's true, but I think somewhere along the line he actually says something like, it's no good just observing nature. You really have to generalize about it. You have to see the big picture. And it's there in everything he writes, right through his life, the big picture, the possible. He works out in his head all the time how something could have come about along the lines of his basic notions. That's what I love most.
Well, here on The Book Show on ABC Radio National with me, Ramona Koval, I'm speaking with Dr. John Van Wy, science historian at Cambridge University, and Sue Asher, e-text creator and volunteer with the Darwin Online Project. Sue, I understand one of your principal aims in creating e-texts is to make works accessible for people who have difficulty with printed texts. So what inspired you to create these texts that can be heard as well as read?
Well, I had a colleague who went blind literally overnight with some sort of autoimmune disease. And he was this wonderful person who went from 3 books a week and 3 crossword puzzles a day and 4 magazines a day to absolutely nothing. And in conversations with her, I sort of was made aware that there really wasn't much out there for the blind. And she was able to get Talking Books, but Talking Books are a commercial publication. You have to buy them, and most of them are abridged. And you can't, at that time, of course, you couldn't download them. And when I realized the unbelievable, the magical resources in the Project Gutenberg text, which is where I started doing this stuff, I just got quite excited about that. And I got my best bouquets from people who had trouble with the mechanical processes of reading paper books, and I just got a lovely kick out of doing it.
So, John, it's a massive collection already, 90,000 images. Have you got any idea at this stage how large it could become? I mean, what else would you put on it?
Well, we actually have 150,000 images, and I don't know how many thousand electronic texts. The future will probably involve transcribing a lot more of Darwin's handwritten documents that are now just pictures. Someday I'd like to make all of that searchable as well, because there's tens of thousands of pieces of paper with Darwin's writing on them, and because they're handwritten, we'll never be able to put them into a machine and turn them into words. So that's one direction for the future. And another is to gather together the books that Darwin used in his work. So all the things that he read and cited, I'd like to put those in to sort of restore Darwin's writings, which we now have, into their original context, because Darwin wasn't in a vacuum. He was in a part of a scientific community. And I think what Sue was saying is absolutely right. And by now making these things available online for free, unabridged, everyone can access them, no matter what their abilities. And another direction, of course, would be to have them in other languages. Mm. Now, at the recent launch of Darwin's papers, we had 7 million hits on the launch day, and a large percentage of these were actually from translation internet services like Google Translation and things like that, which show that people from non-English speaking countries were accessing and using the site and using automatic services to translate the pages into their own languages.
Oh, God knows what the translations looked like if it was done
indeed,
by
so,
you know, just a simple translator on the net.
Yeah, that you can't predict that, but we do have several 19th century translations already available. We have most of the Darwin's in German, all of them in Danish, some Russian, and I think I've forgotten a couple of other languages. And it is very exciting to have all of this material in one place. One thing I can say from the technical data behind the scenes is that it seems likely that Darwin Online has now distributed more copies of Darwin's books than all the publishers in history, which is a pretty exciting event.
It certainly is. And Sue, are you now an expert in the handwriting of Charles Darwin?
Can't read it, sorry. I need to have it transliterated for me, I'm afraid. It's very difficult.
Well, I guess you're the expert, John.
Well, it is very difficult handwriting, and it often takes a whole team of people to get through it in the end. But I must say that we are enormously grateful for all the work that Sue has done for the project. I mean, she's by far the greatest volunteer and has done.
She's the Queen Bee volunteer, no doubt.
She is indeed, yes. I think the public good that Sue has done with all of her work, making it available free, she deserves a medal.
Well, we'll see what we can rustle up. Dr. John Van Wy, thank you so much for being on the book show today.
Thank you.
And John is a science historian at Cambridge University, and Queen Bee Sue Asher, eText creator and volunteer with the Darwin Online Project. Thank you to you too, Sue.
You're very welcome.
And you can see the documents and images and scribblings we've been talking about and thousands of others at darwin-online.org.uk, and we'll put a link to that website on our own website at abc.net.au/rn/bookshow. Now, the defiant figure of the female outlaw doesn't exactly dominate stories of early Australia. Instead, we have the blokey Ned Kelly and his crew populating the mythological landscape with tales of daring and bushrangers, although sometimes even in frocks. But Australian writer Fiona Capp has imagined a story that blends her own family's journey to the Victorian goldfields in the late 1860s with a proper female outlaw, Gemma Musk. She's an artist and an independent woman who challenges the moral code of the small town she lives in, Wombat Hill. Fiona Capp has written two novels, Night Surfing and Last of the Sane Days, but she's also written a memoir, That Oceanic Feeling. So in her latest novel, she brings these two worlds together, her family history and the imagined landscape of fiction. At the Sydney Writers' Festival, Fiona Capp spoke to the book show's Sarah Lestrange about her novel, Musk and Burn. Fiona begins by recounting the fantastic journey that forms the background to this novel, that of her great-great-grandfather who travelled from Switzerland to Australia with his herd of cattle.
When I was growing up, I was aware of a story that my father had told us and that was written in a family memoir about my great-great-grandfather who had come out from Switzerland with his herd of dairy cattle. This is in the 1850s. He'd herded them down to Naples, shipped them to Southampton, shipped them to Melbourne, then herded them up to Daylesford in the central goldfields of Victoria, where there was a thriving community of Italian-Swiss living. Then, so the story went, after a few years of working as a dairy farmer, pleuropneumonia swept through the region and wiped out all of his herd. And I was quite fascinated by his story because it was quite a dramatic one, a classic story of an odyssey from the other side of the world and then one ending in tragedy. So that was the origins of my idea for his character in the novel.
How has your family reacted to the retelling of the story of your great-great-grandfather as he appears in this story, Musk and Burn, with Gemma Musk?
Mostly well. I mean, we've all grown up with the same stories, and I think they've enjoyed going into the story in some depth through the way I've imagined Gitaro. I was a little bit concerned that members of the extended family might have differences with the way I had perceived Gitaro, but a number of them have done their own research into Gitaro's story and found the discrepancies between the myth about Gitaro that we've all inherited and the actual facts, as I found it too. And so I think they're all quite happy with my take on Gitaro because they realise that basically what we're all dealing with is myth. But what was useful for me about drawing on family history was that it was a way into the past and it gave me a sense of connection with the past that I wouldn't otherwise have had because my father can still tell stories that were passed on to him by his father who remembers Gitaro from when he was a boy. And sometimes it can be really hard as a novelist to project yourself back into the past, no matter how much research you do. But when you have a personal link with it, for me, it made a big difference.
So this novel, Musk and Burn, is set in the late 1860s in the goldfields of Victoria. And your great-great-grandfather appears in this novel. He marries the heroine of the story, Gemma Musk, and she's a bit of an outsider. Where did you get the idea for Gemma Musk from?
The idea for Gemma Musk came from someone else's great-great-grandmother. That other person is Judith Wright, who is a poet who I've loved since I was a teenager, and her work has been very influential on me. There's a particular poem called Request to a Year in which she describes a sketch that was made by her great-great-grandmother whilst sitting on the bank of a river in Switzerland, watching her children playing on the ice. One of the children, her son, is on an ice floe that starts to head down towards a waterfall, and her daughter manages to reach out a stick and save the boy. But the mother, intriguingly enough, sits there and sketches the whole scene. And I was fascinated by the detachment required of someone, of a mother, to sit and draw a scene rather than leap up and try and save your child. And so that was the origins of the idea of Gemma as this very driven and committed artist, and also the tensions that she would encounter between being an artist and being a mother.
Well, just so that we can see the links between that story that you write and the story that you draw from the Judith Wright, would you be able to read this Judith Wright Request to a Year?
If the year is meditating a suitable gift, I should like it to be the attitude of my great-great-grandmother, legendary devotee of the arts, who, having had 8 children and little opportunity for painting pictures, sat one day on a high rock beside a river in Switzerland and from a difficult distance viewed her second son, balanced on a small ice floe, drift down the current towards a waterfall that struck rock bottom 80 feet below. While her second daughter, impeded no doubt by the petticoats of the day, stretched out a last hope alpenstock, which luckily later caught him on his way. Nothing, it was evident, could be done, and with the artist's isolating eye, my great-great-grandmother hastily sketched the scene. The sketch survives to prove the story by. Year, if you have no Mother's Day present planned, reach back and bring me the firmness of her hand.
Fiona Capp reading from a Judith Wright poem called Request to a Year, which formed part of the inspiration for her latest novel, Musk and Burn. And the novel opens with her sketching a scene of a family and something very dramatic happens. Can you just tell that story? Because the imagery and the way you describe it in the book is just so wonderful. And this gives us a clue as to why she becomes a social outcast in this small community in the central goldfields of Victoria.
As unlikely as this event sounds, it's actually based on a news item that I came across about a young girl who was out in the bush She was wearing crinolines, and a gust of wind came along, swept her up into the air and deposited her over the ventilation shaft of a mine. So I have Gemma out in the bush. She's sketching a family having a picnic, and the wind suddenly changes, well, the weather changes, the wind sweeps this girl over this ventilation shaft. And Gemma madly sketches the scene. She's too far away to actually go and help, but the fact that she sits there and sketches it outrages the family and outrages the town too, because she wasn't seen to be behaving in a way that a woman ought to.
And she becomes somewhat of an outlaw through the novel, but not because of any criminal deeds she's done, but because of her independence that sets her apart. And that is borne out through the incident with sketching that child, that scene when the child is maybe going to die and her just sitting back and sketching away, not running to help. This sets her up as, you know, being a bit of a social outcast. What were you trying to look at there by setting her up in this way, with the intersecting elements of her own life of independence and as an artist?
I wanted to look at the price that a woman at that time would have to pay to be a committed artist, and what would happen when she became a mother, and the tensions between being an artist and being a mother. So that was the more personal dimension of what I wanted to explore. And Gemma does change in her attitude towards her art when she becomes a mother. And after a tragedy strikes her family, she gives up all. She gives up painting. She loses all desire to work as an artist. She looks back on her former self with a kind of wonder, because she can no longer understand what drove her. She does rediscover her love of art, but in a more reflective and less driven fashion, I think. More generally, I was interested in how women, especially in the past, although it still happens now, don't need to break the law to be considered what I call moral outlaws, that they can be ostracized or demonized by society merely because they overstep this unwritten law about how a woman is supposed to behave. And the classic case is that of Lindy Chamberlain, which was really uppermost in my mind when I was writing Gemma. The way Lindy Chamberlain was so readily portrayed by the media as criminal. And she was prosecuted, but then she was finally cleared of having killed her child. But what interested me was the way the public was so ready to believe that she had actually killed her child, and the kind of moral outrage that accompanied this belief that she had done so. So that was the broader dimension that I wanted to explore.
And so, without going into detail about what actually happens in your book, Musk and Byrne, Gemma Musk, she's married to Gotardo Valletta. A tragedy strikes. She runs away from the rumour and gossip. She runs away possibly from the gallows, but she runs away with another man, Nathaniel Byrne. This is the point at which she becomes a moral outlaw and all of these stories spread about her. Would you be able to read from a section of the book? This is a part when Nathaniel Byrne is reflecting on this element of how myth is created about he and Gemma that he's taken no part in.
Nothing makes sense anymore. He's long since stopped believing that these smudgy columns of newsprint will reflect the world as he knows it, has long since stopped believing in the idea of news. It might be novel, but that's a far cry from fact or the real complexities of people's lives. For months now, he and Gemma have watched with disbelief as the myth of Musk and Byrne has gathered momentum, each new report adding to the already feverish speculation about their whereabouts and their supposed misdeeds. Nathaniel has come to realise that evidence and truth are irrelevant when everything hinges on what people wish to believe. The stories take hold like Chinese whispers until even the most unlikely incident emerges as shining proof. Only a week ago, he and Gemma were alleged to have conducted a robbery at a general store at nearby Merrick's. Woken in the middle of the night by what the owners first thought were possums which had come down the chimney and started knocking things off the shelves, they discovered instead a man and what looked like by candlelight to be a boy ransacking the shelves. When challenged, the pair rushed out the door, each with a sack full of goods. The man flung himself onto his horse, but the boy couldn't mount with his sack. "Jem, leave it," the man was heard to cry. Immediately, the boy dropped his sack, and they both galloped off into the night. The magic word "Jem" was enough. The boy was a woman. It was the owner's conviction that the robbery was the work of Musk and Byrne. Since then, everyone in the district has been talking about it, bringing the whole farce uncomfortably close.
Fiona Capp, reading from her latest novel, Musk and Byrne. You've written about the process of writing this story of Musk and Byrne, and you have said that in earlier ideas about the story of Gemma Musk as an outlaw, you actually had her doing criminal acts. What sorts of things had you originally imagined for her?
I had imagined that after Gemma and Gattardo lose their herd to pleuropneumonia, that they would take up cattle duffing, and or that Gemma might do it on her own, and then it might cause tension within the marriage because she felt that she needed to do something to bring some money in. So I had these more conventional ideas about what kind of criminal acts she might perform. And then as I thought about it more, I thought that it was fairly unlikely that someone of her background, and a woman in particular, would be involved in these kind of criminal acts. And I didn't want to find myself writing a melodrama. I wanted it to be something that people could believe in. So I pulled back from this conventional notion of how she might have become an outlaw and began pursuing more the way her personal behaviour, her attitudes as an artist and as a woman, her unconventional behaviour as a mother, how all these things might coalesce in a perception of her as potentially criminal and definitely as a figure who's overstepping the moral bounds.
In Australia's history, the figure of Ned Kelly looms large as a founding story of Australia. Do you regret the fact that more women aren't part of these stories of rebellion and freedom?
Yeah, I do. One of my favourite movies is the movie Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. And, of course, the two heroes are Butch Cassidy and Sundance. But the third character in the story is Etta, who's the girlfriend of Sundance, and she plays an important role too. I've always found her a really inspiring figure. She's a school teacher, and she finds a life of adventure on the run with Butch and Sundance. But in the end, she pulls back because she can't go where they're going. Then there's Thelma and Louise, which is a movie which I really enjoyed because you've got two women in that kind of Butch Cassidy Sundance Kid role. And, I mean, it's very much modelled on that film. But in a way, I felt that Thelma and Louise are kind of Butch Cassidy and Sundance in drag. They're not doing something that's pushing the boundaries in terms of the representation of what women might do. And so it seemed to me that one of the more effective ways to explore woman's role in outlaw mythology was to explore the moral outlaw figure. But it would be nice to think that there are other ways of exploring the way women can rebel and be these adventurous and defiant figures in a way that's characteristic of the way a woman would behave and not just a copy of men.
Fiona Capp there, speaking with a bookshare's Sarah Lestrange at the Sydney Writers' Festival last weekend. And Musk and Byrne, B-Y-R-N-E, is published by Allen and Unwin. In his collection Why Not Catch 21, the stories behind the titles, Gary Dexter has compiled the stories of how our favourite works ended up with their names. From Plato's Republic to Catch 22, like a detective, he delves into the author's world to unpick the clues that explain how the titles we now take for granted came to be. He's already told us how Joseph Heller came up with the title Catch 22. But what about George Orwell's classic 1984? Orwell's work title for the book while he was writing it was The Last Man in Europe. So why 1984 instead? Here's Gary Dexter.
There are several different theories about where 1984 came from. I think probably the best known is to do with the date in which Orwell completed the book, which was 1948, although it was actually published in 1949. And the digits, the last two digits of that year, 1948, reversed are 84. So that's one explanation. One seems to attract a lot of people. There are a couple of others which I think are a little more obscure. The first is that Orwell admired a book by Jack London called The Iron Heel, which was published in 1907. And in that book, there is a date, the date 1984, which exists in a footnote. It's actually the date of the founding of a city, Asgard. Now, Orwell, as I say, admired this book. This is a book about a future fascist dystopia in America. So there are some similarities there with 1984. So that's another interesting resonance. A third theory is to do with Orwell's first wife, Eileen O'Shaughnessy, who wrote a poem in 1934, which contains the year 1984 in the title. It's called End of the Century, 1984. And she submitted this to her school magazine in 1934. She was not school at the time. She just left school and she sent it in. It was published in the school magazine. And this also has seems to have a totalitarian theme. It deals with a future society in which the population are controlled by telepathy, by this group of scholars. So there's also this interesting correspondence, I think. And this is long before Orwell had begun writing 1984. But there does seem to be a resolution of this, in that when Orwell began writing the book in 1943, he set the action in 1980. And as the book advanced, as the decade advanced, he advanced the action to 1982, and this can be seen in the manuscripts, and then finally to 1984. So the date 1984 does seem most persuasively to be a function of how long it had taken Orwell to write the book in the first place. And it does seem that he wasn't really that much wedded to 1984 as a title anyway, because his working title for the book throughout most of this time was The Last Man in Europe. And in fact, when asked by his American publisher which of the two he preferred, he said, well, it doesn't actually really matter that much to me. He didn't think it mattered that much whether a book had two titles, one in Britain and one in America. So 1984 seems to be finally something that he simply wanted to set the book 35 years or 30 odd years in advance of the time that he was writing it, and that really seems to be the explanation of that particular title.
There you are, but The Last Man in Europe just doesn't have the same ring, does it, as 1984. Gary Dexter explaining how George Orwell's 1984 got its name. His book is called Why Not Catch 21, The Stories Behind the Titles, and it's a Francis Lincoln book distributed here by Bookwise. This is The Book Show on ABC Radio National. I'm Ramona Koval.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.